the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com, where we ask the question, will America ever hear the entire Benghazi story? Well, it's bound up in a lot of secrets, classified operations, potential CIA gun running, many other issues. Today, we're talking with Larry Hancock, an investigative reporter and author who has worked with Stuart Wexler, who was a guest on our program most recently. Wexler and Hancock wrote a book called Shadow Warfare a few years ago, and Hancock's most recent book is called Surprise Attack. And he's going to share with us some of the information he has about why we'll never find out the truth about Benghazi, that the Republican fishing expedition isn't really trying to catch the right kind of fish. And he'll also comment on the failure of Congress to exercise its role in war powers related to the new military adventures in Iraq and Syria. And before the end of this podcast, Will Durst, the San Francisco political satirist and comic, will check in with his thoughts about the Benghazi hearings. Before we get down to business, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Folks like Perry Productions. Thank you, Mr. or Ms. Perry, for renewing your annual subscription. And monthly subscribers Kevin Beckley, Mona Kobus, and Anna Gordonier. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. On the homepage, look for the menu button. You click on that. And on the pull-down menu, click on Become a Subscriber. At the next page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount via PayPal or mail in a check or money order or good old burnable cash. However you choose to support me, I hope you will, and thanks for listening. Benghazi, 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 Benghazi. The real big question that we've been asking for ages is, why did the U.S. topple Gaddafi to begin with?
Salutation to the people of Libya! Solidarity in action, solidarity forever! Great salutation to the brother leader, Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi, the Commandant General of the International Libyan Forces, the leader of triumph and defiance!
He's billed as the poet of Africa, that is Olani Makiva, and a song about Muammar Gaddafi. And joining me today is investigative writer Larry Hancock. He has partnered frequently with Stuart Wexler on writing assignments over the years, delved deeply into domestic terrorism, the Martin Luther King assassination. I most recently spoke with Stu Wexler about his new book, America's Secret Jihad, and Wexler and Hancock collaborated on Shadow Warfare, a history of America's undeclared wars that was published last year. Larry has also published Surprise Attack, From Pearl Harbor to 9/11 to Benghazi, which appeared just a month or so ago. Larry, thanks for being with me today.
It's great to be here.
I was intrigued by a piece that you published at Russ Baker's important website, Who, What, Why, recently. It was just after Hillary Clinton endured her 11-hour grilling before the Trey Gowdy Select Committee on Benghazi. And as most people are aware by now, not much new really was generated from the heat of that exchange. And politically, it's seen as a loss to the Republicans. But I'm not that interested in that political skirmish. To me, the questions are, you know, what was the facility or our installations in Benghazi really about? And the bigger question that Trey Gowdy hasn't really found time for, because he's so busy rifling through Hillary's emails, is, you know, why did we go in there to begin with? So let me start. Your piece at Who, What, Why gives a pretty good succinct explanation. Tell us your view of what Americans were doing in Benghazi on September 11th of 2012.
Well, I think the quick answer is whatever they had intended to be doing when that diplomatic facility had been opened, and perhaps they were more optimistic at the time, by the fall of that year, I think the fact was that the diplomatic facility itself was routinely staffed by only one individual, rotated out of Tripoli, and the embassy, the facility, was used as a cover for a much larger CIA operation that had been building all year long.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the committee's point of looking at State Department and asking State about its mission in Benghazi and why are you there and why did you stay there is an example of looking at it from exactly the wrong end. The real questions should have been asked of the CIA as to what their mission was. State clearly was simply providing employment cover.
Mm-hmm. And if the Gowdy Committee were really serious about understanding just what you are starting to explain here, Larry, they would have brought CIA officials in and said, well, you know, tell us what you were doing. And, of course, they would have said, that's a secret, and if I tell you, I have to kill you. But this is really the tension that has been apparent throughout this entire episode, that whether it's the White House or Susan Rice being pilloried for the talking points that were used or the targeting of Secretary of State Clinton, who I'm not a big fan of, I have to say that they were caught because they couldn't just go on TV and said, oh, yeah, that was a covert CIA operation and blah, blah, blah. So from the get-go, the Republicans had the Obama team over a barrel. They did intentionally politicize it. Reince Priebus, the GOP chair, was tweeting about the Benghazi event just moments after it happened and before we knew that Ambassador Stevens and others had been killed. So the politics of it set in very early, and my view is, yes, there was a cover-up, but Team Obama couldn't really expose the CIA in an effort to tell the truth.
And it's always been that way. What amazes me, or it's a real question, as to whether the committee members on that committee, including some that are on intelligence committees, are really that, really misunderstand national security law that badly, or whether they really were playing a game knowingly. Because they have to know that in any national security operation, when something goes bad, you don't tell the truth. And they are prohibited by law from telling the truth. So the last thing that you could expect is, once that attack occurred, and you're trying to save operations that are in progress, people that are in progress, you still have people out in the field doing things, and you're trying to get your act together to retaliate, you're not immediately going to stand up and spill your guts about what you know really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you put into print here something that I've been mentioning and talking about based on my own sources. You write, the CIA's mission included arms interdiction, attempting to stop the flow of Soviet-era weapons to Central Africa, and, you write, very possibly the organization of Libyan arms shipments to vetted insurgent groups on the ground in Syria. Now, Larry Pepe Escobar, who is an international reporter, he told me well over a year ago that he had been able to confirm that, in fact, the CIA was running these weapons indirectly to Syria. He says that they were shipped to Qatar, where they were then recrated with different markings and then sent to the rebel groups that the U.S. has been supporting in the war against Assad and, more recently, against the Islamic State in Syria.
There was actually some great investigative work doing that on tracking tracking both ship departures and aerial flights. And individuals tracked air flights going from both Qatar and the UAE into Syria. One large shipment of arms sailed out of Libya just before the attack, only a few weeks before, and went to Turkey and on into Syria. One of the more interesting things, though, is there may have been some competition going on, because we know that the U.S. had CIA officers in Syria that summer looking for the right groups to supply, and those weren't necessarily the same groups that are being supplied out of Qatar and UAE. And there seems to have been perhaps a little competition in, well, perhaps a little less concern over who was getting the arms for them that was going through the Arab channels as to those that we were taking in through Turkey.
And, this you pointed out to me before we started recording, Larry, that by grabbing these Soviet-made or Soviet-era weapons from Libya and transshipping them ultimately into Syria, it would at least create the perception that, well, these aren't U.S.-supplied arms because, after all, we would buy them from an American manufacturer, not the Kalashnikov LTD or whatever they call the company that makes them.
We want it to look like we captured them from Assad's forces. This has been a game that we've played for decades. It's surprising how many people think that we actually ship our arms to folks, whereas, no, we have to go find them through third parties, whether they're commercial dealers or it would not be the first time that we took advantage of a revolution to source arms for other purposes.
And so what can you add to this in terms of other sources or other ways of confirming this? It's beyond a suspicion, but of course the government won't acknowledge it. But this scenario of Libyan weapons ending up in Syria.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, and it's not that these are unknown. The committee took some testimony on this, but it's interesting when they didn't even question the CIA security contract personnel who have written a book on their activities in the annex, the CIA station, basically. And they have some very interesting things to say about the number and types of people that were there. And certainly the types of people they're estimating, and talk about 20 to 30 people in that CIA facility. Now, you don't need that just to collect information. You need that for operations. But I find it fascinating that they weren't called even after they had published a book. Another important fact, I think, is that we know, and it's mentioned only briefly in the other congressional investigations, that the ambassador was meeting with the family of the primary largest shipping magnate in Libya, who was a close personal friend. And it's this family's ship who had carried the first shipment of arms to Turkey. Following the ambassador's death, no more ships went out. So that's kind of a negative profile for looking at things, but what appears to have been a burgeoning shipping operation, which would have been fantastic because you could take very large quantities much more quickly than you can take them by air and transship them all the way around the Arab countries, and that stopped. So you have to at least speculate that the ambassador was not just aware of this activity, but the ambassador might have at least been offering his personal connections and personal endorsement of the activities.
Well, Larry, I just marked up your, I printed out your story, and I put some notes along the margins here in different places. And in your paragraph here where you describe Stevens had been in Benghazi, had not been in Benghazi for a year, and he, you know, had been sent into Libya. We know that Secretary Clinton testified that they basically snuck him in. And so it raises the question, and I recognize we can only speculate about this, but to what extent the ambassador was using diplomatic cover on missions for the CIA. He certainly had to be aware of them. Whether he was an actual party to these alleged weapons transfers is a different question, but I think it's a pretty meaty one.
And it's a very good question that could have, well, it wouldn't have been answered in committee, but the discussions have focused on the fact that the ambassador was aware that there was risk. And if you look at the ambassador's own messages and some of his own comments, he knows the situation in Benghazi is degraded and that, quite frankly, at that point in time, since he's only rotating one person in to be protected by local militia and contract security personnel, there's not a lot of diplomacy to be handled. And it's also known and well established from the other committee hearings that he was, quite frankly, being given more initiative than the regular U.S. ambassadors normally are. For example, Clinton did back away from not having talked to him. The point being, obviously, if she had talked to him, she couldn't talk about it in committee.
Mm-hmm.
So my speculation would be that he was given a lot more authority just because he had established some excellent personal contacts when the revolution was going on. And by the way, initially when the revolution was going on, he first went in and stayed at a hotel and then apparently resided for some period of time in a CIA complex before this diplomatic facility was opened. So there's just some reason to think that he's doing what American diplomats have often done, is pursuing national security interests, not just pure diplomacy.
And Larry, when we zoom out a few feet from the close-ups of the select committee hearing with Secretary Clinton testifying, it struck me as a kind of bizarre game of classified chicken. That you know, everybody who is in the room who has a security clearance knows the things that you and I are talking about. Yet they all know that they can't blurt them out in public, and they have to use coded language. They have to stick to official public narratives and avoid stumbling into the secret narratives. And Trey Gowdy himself inadvertently disclosed some classified information as he was hammering Hillary for emailing classified information. And so we see that those are the points where the people kind of hit the electric circuit that surrounds this whole thing. But it is truly bizarre to see them go through the motions of all this when they all know the real facts, or certainly those facts may go much deeper than what you and I can present here today.
And they are, but when Stu and I did our work for Shadow Warfare, we kept running into this over and over again because it's a fascinating game that Congress gets to play. Because of the legislation that was passed in the 70s when Congress was trying to get a real handle on covert operations in the CIA, the president has to inform Congress of major covert operations. However, Congress is totally free to do whatever they want to do with that information in terms of either pushing back to him directly, passing new legislation, or using it for the same sort of thing that we just saw. They can't violate their security laws, but they can know exactly how to position things in advance so that the administration is essentially up against the wall.
Mm-hmm. So you headlined your story, Why America Will Never Hear the Entire Benghazi Story, subtitled Pin the Tail on the Donkey.
Well, yeah, there was a little political context there, I guess. But that effectively is the way it works, because if you have a committee that is being driven by a party, which obviously this was, and it's happened on the other side too, this time they have the advantage of knowing where to draw the lines and where they can't cross the lines. But that's okay, because they're asking questions. They're not going to look bad. It's almost impossible for them to look bad by not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing can be, it is a game of pin the tail on a donkey. They know what the target is. They know what the boundaries of the game are. And they're in... If you know, the thing is, the interesting thing is, if they had stopped after one or two hearings, they would have been way ahead.
Yeah.
It just really becomes stupid when you keep asking the same questions over again. And when you step back and look at it from a broad level, we have had 2 to 3 times as many congressional inquiries about Benghazi as we had 9/11. And none of these same kinds of questions, as far as command and control, national command authority responsibilities, nobody asked Bush or Rumsfeld or Cheney the level of detailed questions that are being asked of Clinton.
Well, and let me give you a very good example, Larry. I attended some of the public hearings of the 9/11 Commission. And it was a sick joke and a whitewash. And I was there the day Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense, was testifying in public. And I just remember this so vividly. He was asked, did you order planes scrambled to defend the Pentagon on September 11th? And he kind of looked around the room, rolled his eyes, and then he repeated the question. He said, did I scramble jets to defend the Pentagon on 9/11? And then, fortunately for Rumsfeld, Chairman Tom Kaine, the former governor of New Jersey, pounded his gavel and said, time's up, next question. All right, and that's just one example of you know, the mile-wide, half-an-inch-deep work of the 9/11 Commission, and you're correct that Benghazi has been, you know, much more of a focal point. It's been over-investigated, obviously, and I believe because it shows up in Republican polling that the primary and base party voters of the Republican Party seized on Benghazi. They heard about it on talk radio. They heard it pounded on Fox News. And so it resonates with them. But when you present them with the larger and much more troubling question, and for me, much more damaging to Secretary Clinton, which is, why were you so aggressive in advocating for our intervention in Libya to begin with? The president and Bob Gates, then the Secretary of Defense, were both very clear that this wasn't in our national interest. We didn't need to go in there, and that taking out Gaddafi would lead to a replay of the occupation of Iraq and the power vacuum that is created when you blow up a dictatorship. And those questions didn't get aired out in any meaningful way. And as I said, if the Republicans really wanted to get Hillary Clinton, that really plays to her judgment and her foreign policy chops much more than the reactive sequence following the attack in Benghazi.
I do have to almost wonder if it's now become intuitive to them not to want to ask questions about interventions. It's like, maybe we really shouldn't bring up again how you make mistakes by intervening in countries and disposing dictators, because if you do, somebody might remember. And, you know, maybe it's just become ingrained that they don't want to go there.
Well, you can understand their allergy and their reticence. At the same time, you know, the Republicans are really good at creating their own reality.
Well, yeah, that's true.
And you know, anything that Bush did was fine. Anything that's done under Obama is not. And so I still think that, you know, purely on a crass political level, that there's much more traction to be gained by challenging the big picture decision to take out Gaddafi. And, you know, we've got Hillary's infamous soundbite, you know, we came, we saw, he died, which is really, you know, grandstanding and gloating in a way that I think is quite unpresidential. And so to me, there's a lot of fodder there that the Republicans, you know, have no taste for. And, you know, it's not like I'm advising them, but if they want to achieve their goal of preventing Hillary Clinton from becoming president, the overall Libya policy, I think, offers them much more leverage than trying to rehash Benghazi over and over again.
It would have been much more what you'd call forward-looking. I mean, let's look to the campaign and to strategic positions and your decision-making skills. Let's look to something where you would really, where you really made a decision and took a stance. Whereas all this talk about, I mean, she had no command responsibilities. All this talk about her and what did she do? I saw the one questioning series where the Republican congressman was asking her, like, "Were you alone all night?" And it's like,
yeah, that was weird.
That's weird. And you know, really, she's not in charge of any military forces. They shouldn't even be, not that she wouldn't follow what was going on, but those are not her decisions. You know, if you really want to talk about that, you need to talk to the Secretary of Defense. Or, you know, so I agree with you. It would have been much harder hitting if they used it to question her overall strategic understanding of national affairs or decision making, or make her look like a loose cannon.
Well,
I mean, quite frankly, it's sort of like, well, the rest of the administration was really not particularly excited, and you kind of drove them into this. What's going to happen if you get elected?
Yeah. And that exchange with Congresswoman, I think her name is Martha Roby, who asked her, you know, if that night she slept alone. I mean, if I'd been Hillary, I would have said, well, who'd you sleep with that night?
Yeah.
And do you remember?
Remember? And yeah, I mean, obviously it caught Clinton by surprise. It's such a stupid question, which again was one of the things that really irked me about the questioning. All these congresspeople have staff. I mean, could they not come up with good questions? Did nobody look at these and go, you know, you're going to look stupid if you say that? Didn't they not have 10 good questions written down? But not really.
Well, and when they presented the two stacks of emails, one was from 2011 and one was from 2012, you know, and the 2011 one was three times thicker than the one from 2012, it means absolutely nothing. And it's insulting that they would think that the volume of paper represents the level of interest on the part of the State Department and what's going on in Libya, or the level of interaction that's occurring. And it just showed how desperate they were to come up with some sort of a sight gag.
And again, they must know, if she had been talking with the ambassador or even with the CIA about what he was doing, A, that's never going to be in a document. B, it's going to be on a secure phone line. Nobody's ever, I mean, just doesn't work that way. So absolutely, a paper trail is for effect only.
So, Larry, I have not had the opportunity to see your book, Surprise Attack, but the title infers that it extends as far into the recent past as Benghazi. What did you explore in the book?
Well, actually, I start out at the book is about surprise attack from an intelligence, warnings intelligence, how much do you know in advance, and then command and control. How do you really respond to it? And it starts at Pearl Harbor, goes through the entire length of the Cold War, through 9/11, spent a lot of time on 9/11, to Benghazi, and actually extends it to talk about certain of the issues that are going on right now with the Russian Federation and Putin. So the whole goal of the book was to look at broad patterns and, you know, do we keep making the same mistakes? And unfortunately, of course, it's no surprise that Washington doesn't have a great institutional memory, but one of the things that shows up is we keep making the same mistakes, and we make a lot of them after transition from one administration to the other, because whatever one administration might have been doing right it's like the next administration doesn't want to hear it. You know, it won on its own agenda, and that's why Eisenhower really didn't tell Kennedy what was going on about Cuba and the Bay of Pigs. Clinton's people tried to brief Bush and his staff on Al-Qaeda and the Millennium Plot and the Bajinka plots, and they just had their own agendas. And so it's one of the things that falls out is the most dangerous time for the nation may be the first 12 to 16 months after transition.
Mm-hmm.
But that the point of the book is to really look at a whole series of national security incidents, everything from the Gulf of Tonkin, the Liberty, the just a whole series of whether they're attacks or national crises like the assassination of a president, and really examine how all the preparations for those events really play out in real time, how national command authority really works or doesn't work. So it's a pretty lengthy book.
Mm-hmm. Now, based on what you were just talking about our collective amnesia and the way we repeat these mistakes, before we wrap up here, I wanted to reference the book that you co-authored with Stuart Wexler, Shadow Warfare, A History of America's Undeclared Wars. Because as we are speaking here at the end of October, Ashton Carter, the Pentagon boss, has intimated that there will be American combat troops inserted into Syria and Iraq beyond the trainers and advisors. They're talking about special ops, but to me, this is mission creep, similar to Vietnam. And I do applaud the New York Times, and often I find lots to criticize there, but their editorial today on the 28th of October is quite strong and uses many terms of outrage that are a little unusual for the staid editorial message of the Times. But they note that as this mission creep is occurring, Congress refuses to debate or pass any resolutions related to the new misadventure in Iraq and expanded into Syria. And at the same time, hawks like McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham and this nut Tom Cotton from Arkansas are there hammering the Obama administration, essentially urging them to launch a new massive deployment of U.S. troops in this region. And, you know, Obama is correctly resisting that. But I find it fascinating that Congress will not exercise its war powers duties, but it will throw money on an almost unlimited basis at the Pentagon and then hector the president for, you know, not being as hawkish as they are from the sidelines.
That's extremely well stated, and that's what Stu and I ran in over and over again in some 60 years of these types of incidents, that Congress will agitate the public will agitate Congress, and then Congress really won't do anything except quietly increase the funding. And you'll notice in this new agreement that's just been reached in the last 24 hours or so, the funding for overseas military activities is going to be significantly boosted. But the game that they play is they will do that, but they won't pass any legislation of their own. They won't declare war. They might call for war. They won't declare it. And they essentially push it all back on the president. So when it doesn't go well, which it almost always doesn't, they're still in the driver's seat. It just repeats on both sides of the coin, covert or overt, where Congress really plays administrations. And they, again, for both parties, honestly, but they reserve themselves the opportunity to stay at arm's length and then criticize at will. While they're calling for the president to do what they're calling for him to do, and they're funding it, they will be the first ones to jump on it for political purpose. It happens so frequently, there must be a handbook. But
and Congress, you know, will only engage in aggressive oversight on a cartoon level, like going after Planned Parenthood or trying to play gotcha on immigration issues, or, you know, these protracted investigations into Benghazi. But there's such critical issues like the president's authority to designate a person to be killed, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Anwar al-Awlaki. And, you know, nobody is very interested in debating those issues. We don't have policies about how drones are used. And so Congress is basically just abdicating so many of its key responsibilities. And this creates the opportunity for the extension of or the arrogation, if you will, of presidential power by Obama and his successors.
But they really, it's almost as if they really want that, because it offers them cover and an opportunity. I can't see that they're doing it without some knowledge of what's going on. Because, I mean, let's face it, they are the ones that are constitutionally supposed to make the determination of where we get into war. I mean, that's their duty.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, honestly, in my view, I'll be very honest about it, it's like, if you don't intend to do it, don't play at it. And we have done just exactly the opposite. If you want to talk about mission creep, the most recent one was obviously Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
where for some few months, we really were tightly focused. The CIA and the Special Operations Group did what they were sent in to do, and then when that was over, suddenly it became regime building. And Congress never, it's like, wait a minute, who decided that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody decided that, and that's the strategy, the downfall of the whole strategy is if they don't define what the mission is going to be and actually authorize a given mission, presidents, whether they say, I mean, Bush stated clearly that we would never do policing or regime building in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's on record. The man was recorded saying that, but it's like the presidents end up doing that, almost whether they intended to or not, if it's not defined by Congress. And as you said, Congress's oversight, the only thing worse than their lack of ability to actually define missions is their ability to oversee what's going on anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm going to link to your article at whowhatwhy.com so people can read that and reference it. And I really appreciate you joining me today.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's been a while since we brought you a Will Durst commentary. Here's what the San Francisco stand-up comic sat down and talked about after he watched Hillary's 11-hour grilling at the Benghazi committee.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few choice words on the Benghazi hearings. And no, Benghazi is not the guy who hung out with John Cassavetes back in the 60s. That was Ben Gazzara. Benghazi is shorthand for an attack on our Libyan compound. And this was the 8th time Republicans held a hearing trying to blame Hillary Clinton for the death of 4 Americans. Everything is her fault. The Challenger space shuttle blowing up, sinking of the Lusitania, and global warming, which, by the way, doesn't exist. The goal is to damage the former Secretary of State's presidential run. But the overall effect of this 11-hour ordeal was more like spitting in the wind. Most of the effluvium landed on the originators. There could be more blowback on top of Kevin McCarthy forced to give up his run for Speaker of the House after admitting the hearings were nothing more than a political hatchet job. The Republican test for Hillary seems to be, if she doesn't float, she's not a witch. Nobody knows why the former First Lady makes these guys short-circuit like a jerry-rigged discount space heater during a power surge, and nobody can answer the big question, which is how come when 3,000 people died on 9/11, George Bush was a hero, but 4 people die in Benghazi and Hillary Clinton is responsible? Although, for her part, the former New York senator may have overplayed her noble, weary patience by just a tad, especially the part where she pretends to be a 67-year-old grandma befuddled by her email when everybody knows in her spare time she knocks out encrypted navigation codes for NSA drones to skirt no-fly zones. But it ain't over. At the end of the day, the chief marsupial of this kangaroo court, South Carolina's Trey Gowdy, channeled the Chicago Cubs when he said, "Wait till next round." Yeah, oh boy, can't wait. For Wilderst.com, I'm Will Durst.
I think Larry Hancock is right. We'll never hear the entire Benghazi story, but you know more than most people. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.